Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's get right into it. Let's pick the album that we're going to be listening to this week. The album we are going to hear is Joni Mitchell's Hegira.
Or Hegira?
Hegira. I don't actually know how to say that. It is Hegira.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Hegira.
Hegira. Fair enough.
Okay, so what about this album? It's is the eighth studio album by Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell. The songs on the album were written during a series of road trips in 1975 and 1976 and reflect events that occurred during those road trips, including several romantic relationships she had at the time. Characterized lyrically dense, sprawling songs, as well as overdubbed fretless bass played by Jaco Pastorius. Cool.
Oh, wow.
Hegira continued the musician's journey beyond her pop records towards the freer jazz-inspired music that would implement on later recordings. Some of the songs were written while Mitchell traveled as a member of Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Revue Tour. And she performed the album's opening track with the band at their final concert, later released as Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz. Cool. So the first track on the album is called Coyote. Actually, I think I know this song. I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, let's get into the first song, which is called Coyote.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing.
That was very spacey.
Yeah, in some ways.
Yeah.
I thought it was an interesting use of like, what was it, like a flanger or phase shifter on the...
Yeah, I think it was a phaser. Yeah.
Yeah. On I don't know if it was just a guitar, but it seemed to have been like actually placed over top of like a track of multiple instruments. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure about that, but it was an interesting use of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was probably over a couple of tracks because it wasn't over everything.
No.
But it's not like the song... what's the song by the Small Faces? The flange goes over the whole mix. I can't remember the... It's the biggest hit that they had. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, yeah. That's Tin Soldier, isn't it?
No. It's going to bug me if I don't look it up. Ichiku Park.
Okay, yeah, Ichiku Park. Yeah, they did do that on there.
Yeah, but it's interesting hearing the fretless bass in there too, and how. What's interesting to me is how prominent that sound became for this type of music in the 80s. And I didn't really realize that until now. It's like, wow, that would kind of was everywhere for a while.
Well, that it's funny. That fretless bass sound is very... I mean, you heard it a lot in the 80s. I know it's all over Paul Simon's... for pity's sakes, what's the name of that album?
Graceland.
Yeah, the Graceland album. But... it lasted beyond. It seems like more of a folk rock thing. Mm-hmm. Like you would hear that right, certainly through the 90s and even into the early 2000s, and still turns up every once in a while. I know I've heard things by James Keelahan and Stephen Fearing with that sort of stuff on there, the David Woodhouse sort of style playing the bass. And I guess, yeah, it's just a very, it's a tone that honestly doesn't turn up everywhere, but it only turns up in like a certain style of rock or folk or combination of the two of that. You wouldn't hear it in like hair metal or anything. Like
no,
that.
Probably not. I can't see Metallica all of a sudden pulling out the fretless bass, going, "Hey guys, here's a."
Yeah, it wouldn't exactly. Yeah, it's hard to say what they would do, but it wouldn't sound the way you would think it would.
No,
if they were to do that,
it might actually sound cool in that context with some overdrive on it or something.
Yeah, it might be sort of kind of cool. This is a food for thought. Anyway, so the fretless bass and the flanger. Interesting. It's like a story song.
Yeah.
And she's sort of talking about this character that she calls the coyote that's just kind of in and out of her life, and who honestly sounds like he's a little bit of a flaky kind of dude. Yeah.
Well, I was just reading about the song, and it's about how, I guess it's about her. It's really more about her and how, because she's a touring musician, it's hard to make connections with people.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's hard to... I mean, you can make connections with a whole lot of people, but it's hard to make a really strong, solid connection because you're going to be... You're bouncing around all over the place, and a lot of these people are static.
Yeah.
And, yep.
Well, I mean, as far as touring goes, I don't know if I could actually do it at this point. I mean, I would do it and it would be fun, but I think it would get, I would go a bit crazy, I think.
I couldn't spend like an entire year doing nothing but touring.
No.
If I did a tour, I might pick a couple months out of a while and go to a couple places, come back, maybe then continue or do a different tour or continue the tour for another couple months, like a month or two later to go to a couple of other places.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, you know, depending on where you are established as a musician, like how much freedom do you have to actually dictate that sort of thing?
Yeah.
I mean, at the beginning stage, you probably have a little more control over that. When you start to get into more of the, you've got a whole bunch of, you got an entire record industry depending on you to make the money, you have less control over that. And then when you become really big, you've got all the control over that again. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Not to mention, you know, spending that much time with those people, with a few people, you probably want to kill each other by the end.
Just ask the Beatles.
Well, yeah, ask the Beatles. Well, they seemed to be, when they were touring, they seemed to be on good terms with each other. It was everybody else that...
Yeah, but they were also constantly in the... Even when they weren't touring, they were constantly in the studio because they were expected to put this out and put that out, and then there was still so much association with them. But yeah, I mean, living on top of each other, even when they weren't touring, is basically... But yes, a lot of bands have definitely suffered through that.
Yeah, but I can understand where she's coming from too, writing this song, and just it's hard to make a connection with anyone.
Mm.
But let's get into the next song, which is called Amelia.
The drone of flying engines is a song so wild and blue. It scrambles time and seasons if it gets.
I really like that one.
That one was pretty cool. That one's got a lot of It's very visually stimulating, the way she's described things. There's a lot of visual cues in it.
Yeah, it's very cinematic. Like, you can actually picture it.
Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah.
Also, the textures of the instrument. This is going to be an interesting album, I can tell, just by the textures that she's using on this stuff. Like, the acoustic guitar with, I guess it's like a Barkus Bailey pickup right, like, underneath the bridge, picking up this thing, being filtered through, it almost sounds electric, but you can clear it's definitely an acoustic. There's nothing... This isn't a 335 or something like that. Giving that real, it's almost like an earthy metallic sound.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. And also pedal steel, or I think it's a pedal steel, might have been a lap steel in the background. I could hear Fender Rhodes in there occasionally, and I think there was probably something like a Telecaster with an Ebow on it at times. Unless that was just pedal steel doing stuff as well. I don't know.
It might have been the pedal steel.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was a pedal steel, because I could hear the way the notes bended. It sounded like a pedal steel. And I think, was there a Glockenspiel in there as well? Or was that the Fender Rhodes?
I think that was the Fender. I don't know what all she put in that thing. I was trying to figure it out. If you heard a Glockenspiel, it's possible that might have been the Fender Rhodes. And some of the upper keys, they sound very chimey.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the hammer.
It's a vibraphone. It's actually...
Yeah. Well, oh, a vibraphone. Okay. Yeah. So you looked it up.
I just looked it up, yeah. Victor Feldman, if you're curious, played the vibraphone on that song.
Okay. Well, there you go.
But yeah, no, it's interesting hearing those two instruments together, that and the pedal steel, because mm-hmm. you associate pedal steel obviously with country music. I know it's used in other contexts as well, but that's kind of the association that it has. And you wouldn't necessarily think that it would work in almost a jazz setting like this, but it does.
A folk jazz thing, but it
absolutely does. And I thought it was really interesting the way that they kind of sort of stacked on top of each other.
Yeah, I agree. Very interesting textures.
Yeah.
Very interesting cinematic song with like these sort of ethereal textures going on underneath it.
And I think if you were to add something or take something away, it would all just fall apart. It's perfect the way it is. Whenever I hear a piece of music, my producer brain kicks in and I think mm-hmm. about what I could do differently. Sometimes not with everything, but sometimes I'll think, oh, that something else, another different drum beat would be better here, or a different guitar tone or whatever. But I don't think I could, I don't think I would change a thing on here.
No.
It's just perfect the way it is.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll move on to the next track.
Move on to the next one, which is called Furry Sings the Blues.
Mm-hmm. Kinky.
I hope not.
I don't think it's got anything to do with it.
High-heeled shoes. Old furry sings the blues, propped up in his bed with his dentures and his leg removed. And Jenny's there.
So I immediately know who she's singing about. Like, I don't know who it is, but I know, like, the way she describes him. I know exactly. I can just picture him in my mind. He's talking about Beale Street, so it's probably obviously talking about Memphis. I get the sense that this is a guy who was maybe a musician in the 50s, kind of washed up a little bit, didn't really do anything. That's kind of the picture that I get.
Yeah. Yeah, 50s or before. Yeah, he's this old blues guy, and it's just kind of like, yeah, he's sort of living his life, and I don't know, for whatever reason, he's lost a leg and lost his teeth and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So he's I don't think he's got a lot of money. He's just kind of, you know, living out his life because everybody he knows is, you know, out on the street in Memphis. So mm-hmm. that's where he's hanging out.
Yeah. It's kind of sad, but I know it's just I don't know if this is a real person or if it's just what she's observed. Again, this album was written while she was on tour, so it very well could have been just walking around in Memphis on a tour stop somewhere and she just taking it all in and wrote a song about it. The instruments on this were interesting. I like the harmonica throughout.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually Neil Young playing that.
The harmonica?
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me. But yeah, it was more of that sort of electrified acoustic and the fretless bass in the back. You could definitely hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seems to be a pretty core sort of production sound around this album, is to sort of be a little bit on the different side of sound textures being put on, especially for 1976.
Yeah.
This seems to be...
a little ahead of the curve.
A little ahead of the curve for some of these sounds, for sure.
That would later become very trendy.
Yes.
Not in a bad way.
No.
But definitely ahead of her time with this album. I'm wondering who produced this. She produced it with Henry Louis. I don't know who. Oh, he produced a lot of stuff. This kind of stuff, like I don't know. He did some stuff with Neil Young, Leonard Cohen. Not surprising. I mean, it is always interesting when a musician, you hear some of their work, and it's like, well, this sounds like 10 years after this. It's like, oh, well,
yeah, I know.
I mean, I guess it had to come from somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know.
Is he like a Canadian producer? It seems that's who he's working with for the most part.
German-born sound engineer and record producer known for his work on many critically acclaimed and successful rock and folk albums of the 1970s and 1980s, particularly those by Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Stephen Bishop. I guess he's just a German guy living in the U.S., producing records.
Interesting. But yeah, he's got a lot of Canadians on his roster.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay. Fair enough.
So the next song is called A Strange Boy.
A strange boy is weaving a course of grace and heaven.
All right, another song full of cool layers and textures. I like the guitar. I don't exactly know what the tone of the guitar is. I know I've heard that tone before in a lot of stuff that came after this, but it was playing some really funky lines and just kind of like it complex lines, but just kind of in the background as well.
Yeah, there was it sounded like a Stratocaster to me. It sounded very, almost like a David Gilmour sort of Strat tone, being played in the back. And, again, that electrified acoustic sound, carrying it around in the back. The drums were around this time. They were really just, sort of hand drums, like djembes and stuff being played through there. And it's sort of a soft, nice sort of like, it sort of marches it along without being too heavy-handed.
Yeah.
Yeah. No pun intended.
Well, I'm not saying that that I would change anything or anything like that, but I kind of kept waiting for the song to pick up in tempo. I don't think it should, but I think it could have
you
if
almost
it wanted
expected
to.
It to.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah. There's some, yeah, every once in a while I hear something, and the first time I hear it, I keep expecting it to go, is it going to pick up?
Yeah.
Nope, it's not picking up.
Yeah.
That's all right.
But, and if it did, if it would have, that would have been cool too, but if, it could have gone either way, and it would have been good.
Yeah, I was listening to it, and I wasn't expecting it to pick up. I'm sort of just listening to the story of this guy who's clearly, he's probably in his, he's been in the army and stuff like that all the way. I'm guessing he's probably in his 40s or 50s or something like that. He might be an ex-Vietnam vet or something like that, but he's decided, I'm just, you know, going to live my life. I'm going to get on a skateboard, and that's how I'm getting around.
Yeah.
And, yeah, all you punk-ass kids can get out of my way.
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was absolutely. And it's, I think if it had picked up in tempo, or if it had done something different, I don't think the lyrics would have meant as much, or you wouldn't have paid attention to the lyrics as much. Obviously, that's the most important thing, especially with a Joni Mitchell album, is
she's really trying to, she's telling a story, and she wants the story to be heard.
Yeah.
More than anything. I mean, the music, of course, is important to it, but the lyrics and the story are her showcase.
Exactly.
So,
But as far as the music goes, it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's subtle, but there's a lot going on, and you have to really pay close attention to listen to what's actually happening.
Yeah, you can sort of tell that they really they paid attention to what sort of sounds they were going to be pushing.
Everything that they chose was really well thought out, and that everything was deliberate, and everything was they weren't just flying by the seat of their pants. They were
exactly
they were very carefully choosing everything.
Methodical.
Sound. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into the next song, which is the title track.
Yep.
Hejira.
There's comfort in melancholy when there's no need to explain. It's just
so one thing I noticed about this album is a lot of the songs have very long fade outs at the end. Like 30-second fade outs.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
So while you're sitting there hovering for the bio, it's coming to wrapping up.
Yeah.
Tick, tick, tick. Yep. I thought it was really interesting how Jaco Pastorius' bass had almost like a sitar buzz to it at times. I thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, and in that song, there were two bass lines. There was that, the fretless bass, and then there was another bass in there as well.
It might have been a double track sort of thing.
Yeah. It was it was odd to have two bass lines, but it worked as well. Like, they weren't interfering with each other or anything like that.
No.
One of the things that I noticed on this track as well is we had talked about how all the sounds were very well thought out and methodical and all that, but it sounded like a lot of the musicians were also free to improvise a lot.
Yeah, I think so.
And they were sort of also like improvising while she's singing, which thought was interesting as well. It's like this, the basic song is here, but you guys are free to do whatever you need to do or whatever you want to do. Just
I think the sounds and the overall sort of atmosphere is very methodical, but as for what they're actually specifically playing, I guess maybe they've got she had a basic idea of what the track was going to be, but she left enough room for them to really kind of expand on and sort of, you know, do what they felt sort of suited as well. Just let the musicians have a little bit of freedom on the tracks as well.
Yeah, which I think is really cool because obviously this is a Joni Mitchell album. And a lot of people would not want to give up that much control over the recording.
Yeah, their name's on it. Yeah.
Their name is on it. This is my album. I'm deciding what everything is going on here. Whereas she is like, well, maybe she's a little more open to collaborating and hearing different ideas, which I think is really cool. And I think when you have that attitude, you open yourself up to new possibilities. Whereas if you're just, you know, and I'm not saying she doesn't have a vision or she doesn't know what she's doing, but she is
magic doesn't happen if you're too rigid.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you lose out on input from other people, if you close yourself off from it, someone might have an idea and it's something you never thought of and it makes or breaks the album. Mm-hmm. It's really cool that she has that attitude that, well, this is my album, but it's a collaborative effort.
Mm-hmm. She's open to ideas from, she's willing to try things that didn't necessarily come out of her own head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
to improve her idea.
Yeah. And it seems like on this album, the notes aren't so important as the overall sound and texture.
Yes,
like they're creating these soundscapes rather than melodies or chord structures. It's like the overall atmosphere is more important than the rhythm or the melody.
It was an ASMR session. They just didn't know it.
Yeah. Before ASMR was
a
thing. So let's move on to the next one. It's called Song for Sharon.
And I saw the long white dress of love on a storefront mannequin. Big boat chugging back with a belly full of cars.
Okay, there was a lot going on with that track. I wasn't expecting to hear the background singers.
Yeah, that came in. That's not a sound that's really so far anywhere else on the album.
No.
So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. There were moments in there where it almost... first of all, the background singers were, I like the way that it was imaged in the stereo image left and right. And I thought the melody they were singing was interesting. It almost didn't fit, but it did. I don't know how else to say it.
It came out of left field, but oddly enough, slotted right in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely the longest track on the album. And I think because of the jazz style, it almost felt like a jam. It felt like a couple episodes ago, like the Grateful Dead doing something on a different style, but a sort of similar feel.
Yeah. Something like that. I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about it.
Yeah.
I thought the flange on the guitar sort of gave it an interesting texture once again.
Yeah.
Just floating in there with the, and the backup singers. It was definitely an interesting, and they have a very interesting part to play, and it's sort of interesting how that sort of worked in there.
Yeah, it was like a call and response type of thing.
Almost,
but not really. It was, it's hard to describe. But
I think so. It's its own thing, honestly.
Yeah.
That's what Joni does.
That's what she does.
She don't take cues from nobody.
Nobody.
I don't know.
So the next song is called Black Crow. That was interesting. The distorted guitar, it was interesting to hear that not as a main instrument, but as a texture.
Yeah, exactly.
I really like that.
Yeah, it was really cool swooping in. I think that song might be my favorite, but I kind of like the funky sort of, it felt to me like more so than most of the songs on this track. I mean, I don't know exactly if this is the case or not, but this song sounded like it came into the studio a little bit more as a fleshed out tune.
Yeah.
More so than a lot of the other ones. Again, some of the other ones might be a lot more, they might have been too, but this had like a real like groove, but also a very these jazzy chords. Mm-hmm. And there was a very definite chord progression going through, but it was a very, again, jazzy on the strange side sort of, but I liked it. I thought it was very cool.
I agree. I think this was this song feels a little more put together. In the sense, like you said, like this feels like more of a, I have this song ready to go. And maybe this was the jumping off point for the album.
Who knows?
It sounded like the guitar, that distorted guitar, was playing with an Ebow or something.
Possibly with an Ebow, or this is 76. The Ebow would have been new at the time.
Yeah.
But it could have just been natural distortion too, or sustain rather.
Yeah, playing with some feedback
I'm pretty sure they had the amp up pretty loud for some of the noises they were making in there. You can get some pretty long sustain on most guitars if you got your amp loud enough and you're close enough.
it kind of reminded me of some of the sounds that Neil Young would get.
Yeah.
It wasn't him playing that, but I wonder if that was maybe the inspiration.
Yeah. Could be. I don't know. I really liked Jaco Pastorius's, you could really hear his chops on this one. Like his bass playing. I mean, for those of you who don't know, Jaco Pastorius went on to be in Weather Report, which is a sort of a jazz fusion band from the late 70s, early 80s, before he tragically passed. I don't even remember what he passed of, but he was really young. He was really a fantastic bass player. I mean, he could do things that a lot of other people just couldn't do. And partly, I think he's one of those guys that really kind of pioneered the whole fretless sound. I don't know of too many bass players that did that before. I mean, obviously, stand-up bass has never had frets. And that's where the idea came from. You pull the frets off a jazz bass or a P bass, which is basically what he did, to sort of mimic not necessarily the overall tone, but some of the tonality of a stand-up, a stand-up bass.
I would say a bass guitar is probably closer to a cello than a stand-up bass.
In a lot of ways, when you think of the size of the body makes a big difference, but I think the scale, like between the nut and the bridge, is pretty similar to a stand-up bass, and that's what they were trying to replicate on a bass.
Yeah.
But yeah, the size of the body will make a big difference, especially if it's still a somewhat acoustic bass. I mean, P bass doesn't really matter, but it's plugged in, it's got pickups picking it up, and I still think it comes off sounding kind of cello-ish in a lot. It's somewhere in between, really, yeah. Actually.
Was Jaco the first fretless bass player? Was he the one that kind of pioneered that?
Fretless electric? I don't know. I'm not 100% sure, but he was definitely there near the beginning, because fretless basses weren't really a thing. A fretless electric wasn't necessarily too much of a thing. I mean, I guess there were electric stand-ups, which were kind of the closest thing, but they sounded more like a standard upright bass.
Yeah, just loud.
The Ampeg had one. I forget if there's another company. Actually, that's where Ampeg got the name from, was the pickup in the peg for a stand-up bass. It's Ampeg.
Oh, okay.
But yes, they actually did have an electric bass, too, and I think they introduced that in the 60s at some point. Anyway, people had been messing around with things like that for a long time, but as for an actual fretless, the way it became to be known throughout the 80s and 90s. Yeah, I don't know how prevalent the idea even really was before Jaco came along. I think he really did pioneer that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Cool. It's an interesting sound for sure. So we've got two songs left. So the next track is called Blue Motel Room.
I'll be thinking of you while I'm traveling home alone. Tell those girls that you...
Once again, changing gears. That was an actual stand-up bass.
There was. I don't quite know what to say about that song. I don't know if that might be my favorite, or if Black Crow is my favorite.
This one was more of she was doing like sort of her version of a classic like jazz, like in the Cole Porter or George Gershwin style of songwriting, and I think she pulled it off quite well. I mean, she obviously has her own sort of style to it as well. But the instrumentation, where she intentionally started to do that sort of like jazz lounge sort of sound with the actual stand-up bass, and she didn't want to play too much around with some more of the experimental things, because she was trying to, again, get that sort of core jazz room sound.
Yeah.
Which is perfectly legitimate for a song like that, especially something called Blue Motel Room. It just really suits.
One of the things that I really liked about this song was there was a moment where like she was sort of scat singing.
Yeah.
But it was like sort of intertwining, and it was different tracks.
It almost sounded like... It almost sounded like the Beach Boys on Pet Sounds or something like that, doing that. Yeah, in the background.
Yeah, I thought that
was really interesting.
Yeah, really interesting, really cool. I don't know. I can't say too much about the song. It's just kind of perfect the way it is.
Yeah.
You know.
simple but effective.
Exactly. So we have arrived at the last song on the album, and the song is called Refuge of the Roads.
I met a friend of spirit. He drank and womanized, and I sat before his sanity. I was holding back from crying.
Sounds like Yoko had the last note there.
Had to get the last word in.
Yep.
That was a cool song.
Yep. Again, came back to all those textures with the some of those more experimental electric flangey fretless textures.
Yeah. Very, yeah. Just, again, one of those songs, like a lot of the songs on the album, just creating a soundscape rather than being too concerned with the details of the song.
Hmm.
Although less than some of the other ones.
Yeah, there was definitely more of a structure here. I mean, yeah. I think they all had a certain amount of a structure. She had a basic idea, but there was a lot more freedom for the instruments or for the musicians to sort of, you know, dance around the idea. The yeah. basic structure.
Yeah, exactly. And just closes the album really nicely. I think it's you know, ties everything up really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I thought this was a really I'm not that familiar with Joni Mitchell's music. And obviously, I think that needs to change because this was an amazing album.
Yeah.
And I know she has a tendency to change it up from album to album. So this isn't like, this is
just a taste of what she can do. She does all sorts of things.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thought this was a great album.
Mm-hmm.
I'm impressed.
Yeah, well thought of. It doesn't fall into the category of things that I listen to a great deal. But yes, it was definitely definitely worth the listen.
Yeah.
It was quite the listening experience.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting, and it was very interesting to hear some of those tones sort of get developed and used for, I'm assuming, one of the first times ever before, you know, they would take over certain segments of the, you know,
yeah,
recording world.
It's interesting when I hear an album like this that bridges gaps between, I guess, different eras or different you know, musical trends or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like we did with the first episode we did with the U2 album, where there was a lot of stuff on there that would later become very common in the 90s.
Yeah.
But it wasn't in the 80s. And no. So it's interesting to hear where certain trends and where certain sounds really get their start.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has an idea and it catches on, and that becomes the standard for 5 or 6 years.
Exactly. Like Gated Reverb with Peter Gabriel.
Yeah.
And then of course Phil Collins came along, used it, and became a huge hit, and then everybody and their uncles and mothers had to do the same thing for an entire decade before people got sick of it.
And something like that where it's it can be done well, but it can be really annoying.
Yep.
Too. So but yeah, it's always interesting when those things appear and those gaps are closed out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all I have to say about the album. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I think we can pretty much wrap this one up.
That's cool.
Number 4, I do believe.
Number 4, yeah. All right, well, if that's everything, I'm Jeremy Boyd.
Yeah, and I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.